All right, I think we're good.
All right. Okay. Fantastic. So, why are we here?
We're here to make a podcast.
But why are we here?
Does that ring any bells?
No, not even in the slightest.
Who's Ichino?
Oh, you profiled me. Good. Fantastic. Where'd you find that from?
Actually, we were looking at your chess account. First, we went to your LinkedIn.
Okay.
And we found you were a chess tutor, and we were interested in your ELO.
Chess.com?
It was on chess.com, but we went from chess.com. We found your profile. We found your profile, and then we went. Where did we go, Fola?
We went to Twitch first.
Oh yeah.
And then from Twitch, we saw your IB stream, your IB results stream.
That's right.
From there, we found your YouTube channel.
That's right.
And we found your short films and your other IB results stream.
So this is from that short film I uploaded in when I was in grade 12. Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Well done. Good find. That's fantastic. How long did it take you to trace that down?
That was about 2 hours of research.
Yeah, about 2 hours.
That's amazing. You guys did your background check. Okay. Did you find my website?
Your portfolio?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so you know everything there is to know about me.
More or less.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, good. So we can end this podcast now. Okay.
On a more serious note, though, can you give the viewers a brief profile of who you are?
Of course. My name is Mingde Yin. I am an MSI 2T3. I graduated from the aerospace engineering option. I am now a first-year Master's of Applied Science student at the University of Toronto Institute for Aerospace Studies, or UTIAS, studying under Professor Christopher Demarin. I'm currently working on a master's thesis project related to space debris removal.
Cool. And you said you were MSI 2T3, just like we're in NSI right now. What made you choose NSI as your program for university?
Yeah, so when I was in middle school, I thought at that point I had my life completely made up and well thought out. That didn't turn out to be the case, but with my judgment at the time, I had figured out that I needed to study aerospace engineering no matter what. And that lasted all the way throughout high school, all the way through grade 12 when I was applying to universities. In Canada, at least, there is no better program for aerospace engineering at the undergrad level than engineering science. So the choice is very obvious. So, funny story about that. I was admitted into MSI on the final round of admission. Mm-hmm. So not during the November round, not during the February round, not even during the March or April round, but at the end of May. So before that, I was admitted into McGill Mechanical Engineering in February. So I thought for about 3 months of my life that I was going to be in Montreal, and I already had apartments lined up and everything, and then suddenly this was around the 20th of May, U of T comes in with an offer and they say, okay, we'd like to give you admission to engineering science. You have until the OUAC deadline, which was like 2 weeks from then to decide. So we drove down to Toronto from Ottawa, mm-hmm. and we took a look. There was a pre-frosh event. I thought, okay, this is pretty good. Let's check out MSI.
That sounds fun.
And from there, you just knew you were going to be part of MSI.
Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. I think the moment I walked in, I don't have the hat with me today, but one of the I think directors or leads from UTAP was standing there, and they were manning like a booth where they were just giving out hats to students. And from that moment, I got a hat and a UTAP sticker. From that moment, I knew, okay, first of all, yeah, I'm coming to NSI. Secondly, I'm joining UTAP, and I already knew I was going to do aero. So the path was cast and the die was cast right there.
So speaking of UTAP, how would you find your experience during that or within that design team?
Absolutely amazing. UTAP, I think, is it's among the best design teams here at U of T, and everybody should try out UTAT if they're interested in aerospace. I think there is so much you can learn from being in a design team, that's for one, but on UTAT specifically, I was in space systems, so we worked on making a microsatellite mission. If you are all interested in working on spaceflight, spacecraft-related things in the future, absolutely join UTAT. Space Systems is run extremely well right now. They have a mission going on. You can participate on building a spacecraft that's going to fly into space, and I think that's really cool. For me, personally, I gained a lot from just being on UTAT. Over the course of the first year, I was extremely fortunate in that we had just started our new mission, which is the mission we're working on right now called Finch. And they were recruiting leads for the new mission. So during my first year on UTAT, I was able to become a lead.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, the first year of university, for me, that was 2019 going to 2020. And 2020 had a global phenomenon happen to it. So we were at home for a year and a half. But throughout the course of that time, the team that I was on, it was for orbit determination and trajectory analysis. And the nice thing about that is all of that can be done completely in software. We didn't have any physical deliverables to work on. No mechanical structures, no PCBs, no circuits to work on. So everything can be done computationally. During that time, working on code for propagating a spacecraft orbit and orbit analysis, I really found my calling for what I'm good at. I ended up writing a lot of stuff related to orbit propagation. I found I really, really, really like doing this stuff. First of all, that let me do a decent job in UTAP. And secondly, it really coerced me towards the direction I ended up taking for my fourth year undergrad thesis and also for my master's, because they're very related to that problem. Throughout the course of third year, when we went back in person, what did I do in third year? Oh, third year is relatively normal. After third year, we went on PEY. After I started going on PEY, that was the end of my tenure with UTAP. I decided to step away so I could focus on work a lot more. But that entire three-year experience from going in first year to coming out third year, very, very transformative and very, very useful. So to anybody who is looking to join a design team right now, first of all, just join a design team. Any choice is a good choice right now. But if you are interested in aerospace stuff, join UTAP.
Right, you mentioned your fourth year thesis and your master's thesis. Do you want to talk a bit about what those entail?
Sure. So in short, both of them are developing guidance laws for spacecraft. So in the space of control systems and in aerospace, there's an entire subfield called guidance, navigation, and control. Navigation control is a very human thing. Guidance is solving the problem. Let me do it in the order: navigation, guidance, control. Navigation is the question, where are we? Guidance is the question, where should we go? And control is the question, how should we go? So my undergraduate thesis was about trajectory planning for a spacecraft. And not just any type of spacecraft, this is for a solar sail spacecraft. So a solar sail is like a sailboat, except it works in space, and it doesn't. So a sailboat works by deflecting the wind on the ocean. A solar sail works by reflecting photons, because photons carry momentum coming from the sun. They're a reactionless form of propulsion, and there are a lot of leading studies right now just talking about how solar sails are going to make the future of spaceflight extremely interesting. The problem of planning trajectories for solar sails is that thrust coming from solar sails is unidirectional. That is, you can't produce thrust directly towards the sun, and you can't sail into the wind. So when you think about the path you're going to take from A to B with a solar sail, planning out that trajectory is a pretty challenging problem, because it's a very, very heavily constrained problem. That was my undergraduate thesis. So over the course of 8 months, I developed a completely novel guidance law for controlling solar sails and planning trajectories to go from any starting orbit around Earth to go to any final target orbit around the Earth. And I think I did a decent job, because I got the paper published, at a conference, and it's now pending submission in a journal. Fantastic experience. And I owe it all to my supervisor, Professor DeMarin. He is a very, very, very talented researcher in the field of solar sails especially, so he was able to give me a lot of mentorship and guidance on it. And just in general, NSAI set me up for success in that regard. So now for my master's, again, it's a guidance law, but now it's not for solar sails anymore, it's for just a regular spacecraft with a rocket engine. But the application is more interesting now, because instead of trying to go from a single orbit to another target orbit, we're trying to do rendezvous. So if I have a target spacecraft which is sitting in a second orbit, I'm not trying to just match my orbit, I'm also trying to get to the spacecraft, which is a more complicated problem. Now, this problem, people have solved this problem. The problem I'm trying to solve here is that extending this problem from going from where I am to one target spacecraft, can I extend this to going from where I am to where I have 100 target spacecraft, and I want to figure out an optimal routing sequence to such that the route I take to visit all 100 spacecraft is going to be time optimal or fuel optimal. So I either have to burn the least amount of fuel or spend the least amount of time getting to there. And that's a very interesting problem.
Is that like the traveling salesman problem?
It's a traveling salesman problem. That's exactly right. So it is a time-dependent asymmetric dynamic traveling salesman problem. Oh. So it's a more broad class of the static traveling salesman problem you see in computer science. But the solution techniques are very similar. But you know this from the standard traveling salesman problem, that in general, the space of solutions for this problem is extremely large. It's factorially large, in fact, right? 100 factorial is a really big number. Yeah. And there's no way we could try to solve this computationally in an exact method. So my project right now, first of all, it's making a slightly tweaked version of the guidance law that people are already using for Orbital Rendezvous, and then making a cheap version of guessing how expensive the trajectory is going to be if you run it through the guidance law that doesn't require you to actually solve for the trajectory, so that we can send this cheap function that approximates our cost into this optimization scheme. And the optimization scheme is, well, we're not sure how we're going to do it yet. There's a bunch of ways to try to figure this out. You can use machine learning, you can use neural networks, you can use quantum computing, you can use more classic ways of solving it as well. But I need to get the guidance law fixed right now. I'm working on lots of issues with it right now, and that's the current state of my research.
And during your you talking about your time at UTIAS, you also mentioned that it was pivotal to you getting your internship positions during PY. Do you want to talk a bit about your 100%. PY?
So getting on UTIAS was absolutely a super, super important stepping stone to getting a good PY position. The main thing that employers will look at when they want to hire you is hands-on engineering experience. One thing that NSHI is, one of the principal drawbacks of coming to NSHI, one of the few principal drawbacks is that you don't get as much hands-on engineering experience compared to perhaps other programs, but I think that is an incomplete statement. For basically any undergraduate engineering program, just the taking courses part of that engineering program is going to get you nowhere near enough hands-on engineering experience for you to actually be competitive when you're applying to jobs. So it's always good to join a design team. UTAT just so happened to be a design team where the environment was great and I could achieve success by being there. And that success led its way to becoming a good resume entry for me to be able to apply to a job with. I'm choosing my words carefully here. The point of getting onto a design team is to be able to do a bunch of good experiences that you can then talk about as evidence to the fact that you are a competent engineer. Mm. By just taking courses and getting good marks, you're showing that you're really good at doing problem sets and timed assessments and, to some extent, group projects. But what companies want to see is that they want to see that you can do real-world engineering projects. And although design teams don't always get you to there, they get you to as close as you can as an undergrad student. So that is why it's so important to be on a good design team.
And about your internship, I think we found that you were at MDA.
Yep.
Do you want to speak to exactly what you did, if you can, or if you want
to?
Or?
So when I was at MDA, MDA is currently working on two things that I was sort of attached to. One is continued maintenance of Canadarm2 on the International Space Station, and another one is development of Canadarm3 for Lunar Gateway, which is launching in another couple of years. So Canadarm2 right now is quite old. It was installed on STS-100 by Chris Hadfield in the year, I want to say 2000. So it's almost a quarter of a century old. So there's a lot of active diagnostic maintenance we want to do on the arm to make sure it can keep on fulfilling the roles that it needs to do on the space station until the space station hits its end of life. One of the most important things that we need to do is to make sure that the arm does not sustain any physical damage which would impede its functionality. One subset of that would be damage incurred from micrometeoroid impacts. So as you know, around Earth, when you're orbiting at the altitude of the space station, your orbital velocity is on the order of 7 kilometers per second, so that's really, really fast. You can also have debris that is orbiting completely opposite in revolution to the space station, going around the other way. So the relative velocity of any debris that might be impinging on your space station is extremely, extremely high, on the order of above 5 kilometers per second. So very, very, very high speed impacts. These are hypervelocity impacts. So it doesn't take a very, very big piece of debris to cause catastrophic damage when it's coming to you at 5 kilometers per second. So what we wanted to do is we wanted to design a vision system that could automatically screen for any signs of damage from micrometeoroid impacts. The signs of actual damage are very subtle. So as we said, these objects can be the size of grains of sand, and the impact crater they actually leave on your arm is going to be a couple of centimeters in size. But if you take an image of the arm from tens of meters away, that actual hole you see on the arm, if it exists, is only going to be a couple of pixels wide. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very strenuous on a human operator who has to review a large volume of these images whenever flight data comes down. So we wanted to try to automate the system. So machine learning, fantastic. We developed a system to do anomaly detection on the space station. And this same anomaly detection system is something that we extend for Lunar Gateway for Canadarm3. Now, it turns out around the moon, there's a lot of dust. And when there is dust, there's potential for hypervelocity impacts. And that's a risk. So that was what I worked on. Very, very interesting. MD is doing fantastic things. And the company is growing every single year. So highly recommend it.
You mentioned during our linear algebra tutorial that you had another co-op during your PY.
That's correct. Do you want to
talk about that?
Yeah. So MDA was actually the second co-op I did throughout the course of my PUI. The first co-op I did, right starting from May 2022, was Spaceride. So Spaceride was going to be Canada's first orbital launch vehicle ever, which was fantastic. It was a really, really, really exciting opportunity to jump at. It was a really small company. So this was a startup company with 30 employees total at its peak. And we were all working extremely hard to try to build this radically different launch vehicle from anything that's been flown before. This was going to be a rocket, which instead of launching vertically from the ground, we were going to sling it onto a balloon, have the balloon float up into the high stratosphere at 30 kilometers, and then launch the rocket from there, to air launch a rocket from the balloon. So this is something that hasn't been accomplished to any commercial capacity, which was extremely interesting to do. Very, very interesting engineering challenge, because on top of just doing rocket science, you now had to do rocket science with the balloon science. So it's a very tough problem to solve, and there's a lot of really, really cool engineering work. So I can talk a lot about this now. At Spaceride, I worked in several different areas. The first thing I did was conceptual design optimization of the rocket. So our rocket's architecture was a three-stage hybrid and liquid fueled rocket. The two first stages were going to use hybrid engines, and the third stage was going to use a methyl ox engine, liquid fueled. But within that space, that architecture space, you can pick a lot of certain fine parameters associated with the rocket. For example, how big is your fuel tank on the first stage? How many engines do you want to put on the third stage? Things like this. So we had this model of our rocket with 42 parameters that we could tune, and these 42 parameters constituted a design space that the final design of the rocket could be realized in. We had a first iteration of the rocket we were manufacturing, and my first job was to basically tweak the model of the rocket that we had, make it more accurate, make it better, make it more flexible, and then run more optimization runs on it to iterate towards a second design of the rocket. This was really, really cool because from the first day that I got hired, I think I got set up with the GitHub repo, and then in the afternoon, my manager was like, okay, yeah, so start working on the optimizer, get to work. That was fantastic. NGI definitely prepares you to jump right into the thick of it. And for the first 2 months of that of my internship, I was working on the optimizer. We got another design for the rocket. But then afterwards, I worked in the avionics department, working on control systems and avionics for the rocket. So we were working towards this objective, which we called captive carry. So captive carry was going to be like this. We were going to have the second stage and third stages of the rocket completely manufactured, flight ready. And we were going to fly that partial rocket on a balloon, a full-size balloon. This is a 30-meter diameter by 30-meter tall balloon that was going to lift the rocket up to 20 kilometers in the stratosphere. We weren't going to launch the rocket, but we were just going to lift the rocket up and keep it captive and carry it and characterize the behavior of the system. So as you can probably guess, this is an extremely complicated flight to actually build, especially with only 30 people at the company. So we were all pushing towards that, and my work was more needed there. So we needed to work on two things. One was control of the actual balloon gondola, which carried the rocket. So the balloon gondola carries four propellers on it, which are used for attitude control. Think of it like a quadcopter, where instead of the propellers facing upwards, the propellers are facing outwards. So you have four propellers there, and then you have two redundant systems for yaw control. Okay. So I designed a controller for doing attitude control of the gondola for pointing the rocket to its launch azimuth. So we were going to simulate the rocket pointing to its launch azimuth, and then a simulated drop and then launch of the rocket. At the same time, the rocket needed to solve a guidance problem. And the guidance problem was planning its trajectory that it would fly into low Earth orbit. So the rocket that we, the system that we were going to use for the rocket was something called model predictive control, where it was going to dynamically, based off of our best guess of how the atmosphere was that day, how much propellant the actual rocket had on board that had evaporated on the flight up, based off of all these performance parameters, the best trajectory that the rocket could fly up to space. So we would have our computer continuously computing that trajectory right up to the point where we release the rocket. We would do a simulated release, and we'd have the rocket continue computing its trajectory as we simulated the flight. So we needed everything on the avionics side completely ready for a flight. That was fantastic, because for the gondola control system, we actually got to the point where we were rebuilding the gondola for captive carry, and we bought a new set of motors and propellers for the attitude control system. So now I got to touch both the software side as well as the hardware side of the system. Super, super, super interesting. As part of a subscale test for before we did captive carry, we took a small size version of the avionics system, well, a portion of it, and we flew on a small helium balloon up to the stratosphere. I know you read my resume, so that was the thing I put on my resume. Flew into the stratosphere and successfully accomplished the flight. Absolutely fantastic experience for that, because that was the an example of a mission that interns sort of built up over the course of 3 months. And then on the flight day, we carried everything in a car. We drove to this place in southern Ontario. We set everything up. We plugged all the power cables in. We inflated the balloon, and we launched it. And then we recovered everything as well, and it was a complete mission, start to finish. That kind of experience, I think, is really, really unique among internships. I think I'd be very, very hard-pressed to find that kind of experience anywhere else. And the cherry on top to that is that the company went bankrupt.
We're just about to ask about that.
That's right. So this was February 2023. Suddenly one day the rug gets pulled. We get a message in the Slack that says, hey, please bring your company laptops to the office as soon as possible. This is a work from home day, by the way. So we weren't expecting to have to come into the office. So we're like, okay, yeah, this is it. Put in our laptops in, and then everybody went drinking. but the reason I say it's a fantastic experience is because it just like how when flying the balloon mission, we got to see the entire life cycle of a mission start to finish. By seeing the company go bankrupt, I got to see a large portion of the life cycle of a startup company. That was a very chaotic month. I think the entire month trying to get myself back on my feet and get another co-op placement, but everything turned out okay. So that's all that matters.
Would you recommend like a big company for co-op or a smaller company?
Definitely a startup. Well, I think, okay, depends on what you're looking for. If you really want to learn and to learn really well, go to a startup, because nothing rivals the ability to actually be able to touch and make big decisions and have a lot of agency in the company than a startup company. Being at Spaceride, I was a 30th of the staff, which means I was 3% of the entire company. You could not say that at many other companies that we work at, you would just be an intern. But at Spaceride, we weren't just interns. We were a substantial part of the workforce, and we were called upon to do tasks as if we were full-time engineers. You get to be part of those big architectural decisions, and you also get to be part of the fine everyday-to-day tasks that you get to do at a bigger company. At MDA, I got to do interesting things, but I didn't get to do things at the C-suite level where you decide the fate of the company's future. Mm-hmm. At Spaceride, I did, which was extremely interesting. Being able to see the project at more than one level of abstraction is extremely useful to learning how to engineer. Because in fourth year, you're going to do a capstone, and you're going to be working on a life-size project. And that life-size project is not something you solve at the praxis level of abstraction. You solve it at the praxis level of abstraction, picking your architecture, but then you actually build a solution. And to build a solution, you can't just put together pieces of cardboard and make 3D prints anymore. You are now, in the case of the EC capstone, you're building circuit boards, you're building robots.
Yeah.
In the case of Aero, you're building an airplane. So that requires working at a bunch of different levels of engineering. So if you can find a place to work during your co-op, which gives you exposure to that, it doesn't have to be a startup, then absolutely jump for it. Yeah.
And I guess you got the best of both worlds, because you got the startup, like the executive decision, like making kind absolutely. Of experience, and then you got like more into the big space of the big right. industry. But there's one thing I want to really, like, I'm just really curious about this. When you're talking about the balloons, so what was the idea? Because I've never heard this before. So what was the idea to put essentially like almost like an airship type Hindenburg?
That's right.
The, like, I guess, mode of transport for the rocket and just place it on top? Because I've seen, like, have you ever seen those images that look really cool, though? The ones with the, like, you know, the Challenger, what were those called? The
Shuttles,
where they put it on one of those Boeing planes.
Oh, I see.
I mean, something like that, except you use like an airship. That's what you...
Yeah, so the best way to visualize this is think of a hot air balloon. And you know how there's a basket where the people stand underneath? Mm-hmm. And there's the basket with the rocket. So
Okay.
So the balloon, I can talk about the balloon. The balloon is really interesting. So the balloon, we had to get it shipped all the way from India. They make the best balloons in the world, for the stratospheric balloons in the world, for the purposes that we were looking for. We were looking for something called a zero pressure balloon. So the way this balloon works, so if you have a party balloon, and you blow up a party balloon, the party balloon, the skin of the balloon is under tension due to the actual pressure of the balloon, even if you put no load on it. So if you design a balloon that has to carry 12,000 kilograms underneath it, well, the tension of the balloon has to first carry the structural load of the rocket and also has to carry the tension from the gas inside. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make your balloon a lot heavier than it needs to. The idea of a zero pressure balloon is that if you use a lifting gas, which is less dense than the ambient atmosphere, you can actually keep the gas inside at zero relative pressure to the ambient atmosphere and still have it be able to produce buoyancy. You just need a really big balloon. But it turns out that if you design a balloon like this, because there's zero relative pressure in the balloon, there will be zero tension and stress in the balloon associated with the lifting gas itself, so the balloon can be a lot more efficient. That's what's called a zero pressure balloon. There's also high altitude super pressure balloons. There are some NASA missions that are flown with super pressure balloons. They're super, super impressive, where the balloon itself actually does have to have positive pressure on the inside. The nice thing about those balloons is that the balloon's a sealed envelope. With a zero pressure balloon, the way it works is that if you inflate the balloon on the ground, you can imagine that atmospheric pressure at the ground is a lot higher than atmospheric pressure at 30 kilometers altitude. In fact, it's about 100 times or so greater. So as the balloon ascends throughout the atmosphere, it actually needs to vent helium to maintain zero pressure in the inside. So we actually have vents in the balloon that come out. And so the structure you get for the balloon is really, really cool. The balloon itself ends up having this shape which you can calculate mathematically, which looks like a teardrop that's upside down. Mm. And beside the balloon, you're going to have the two ribbons on the side which are vents to vent helium continuously as the rocket goes up. And that balloon is, you need a balloon where the balloon envelope is extremely, extremely thin. That's why it has to be a zero pressure balloon in our case. To be able to get the performance, you need to lift an extremely large payload.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
What's like the size difference between them? Like how big does the balloon have to be in comparison?
Sure. A super pressure balloon that has the same size as a zero pressure balloon, it might be able to lift 1 ton. A zero pressure balloon of the size that we want could lift 10 tons.
Oh. Like how big does the balloon have to be in comparison to the payload? Like,
oh, really, really big. So our rocket, the length of the rocket, I think, was 19 meters and the diameter of it was 2.5 meters at its largest. The balloon, imagine a teardrop shape, the widest part of the balloon, the diameter of it was 30 meters and the height of the balloon from base to top is 30 meters as well. So it's a flying building.
Oh, wow.
It's extremely large.
And you're able to get those from India?
Yeah. So they manufacture them. They do a pretty good job with it. So they also manufacture balloons that the French Space Agency uses for their stratospheric balloon missions. Mm. So NASA makes their own balloons in the U.S., but we wanted an international supplier because of ITAR. So we got the balloons from India, and it was fantastic. It came in a crate, like a big wooden crate, because it had to get shipped across the ocean to us. So it took a really long time to arrive. And then we couldn't even unroll the entire balloon in our workshop. Like, it was so long, it would go from one end of the workshop to the other end of the workshop.
Oh, wait, so you guys got the final 30 by, like, 30
size. We had the balloon.
Oh, so you guys came so close.
We did come so close. Short of actually flying it, I think we had most of the stuff ready.
I would have wanted to see it fly.
Yeah, that would have been so cool.
That would have been very cool.
Okay, this is a bit off topic, but what's your tier list of engine size specializations?
Arrow.
So Aero's S tier.
Aero's S tier.
Top tier.
Are we already moving down to A?
Yeah, everything except Aero, everything that's not Aero cannot be S tier. This will be controversial. I like to make things controversial. A tier will be Robo.
Robo.
Whoa. What else is there?
Should we pull up the list?
No, I can visualize this.
Okay.
Robo's okay.
You still want to step on any toes?
No, I can afford to step on toes. Everyone who's still with me at Utahs now is Aero, so we're good. Let's go to B. Then we have Biomed, Enchphys, ECE. What other options are there?
Is MSF.
MSF is C tier.
C tier.
I think there's energy as well.
Oh, energy can go in B tier.
MI.
MI's D tier.
D tier.
D. Oh, what's with the MI hate?
It's just a judgment. I think MI is jumping on the fad of AI right now. I don't mean to say that MI is a poor quality option. My personal ranking is that I think Aero is the best. MI is the least engaging, in my opinion, because it's glorified software development. Mm. You wanted to do software development, go to Waterloo SE. And why do I think the others are okay? I think they're okay. Why do I think Aero is the best? Because Aero has that appeal to it where it would actually drive you to go to NSCI. The other majors, in my opinion, are you're an NSCI, you get to second year, you have not picked a major. It's let me just pick one of these. But Aero is, and Robo, I think, to an extent, are the main majors where you're going to come in and you're going to say, I can only pick NSCI because I know they have the best Aero and they have the best Robo programs. That's going to get a lot of hate, I think, that entire tier list. Yeah. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. But I stand by what I said.
Okay.
We respect that.
Yeah.
For me, it's fine. I mean,
out of context.
As for Aero, works for me because I'm planning on going Aero as well.
Yeah.
But we noticed, like, even looking back on like your high school videos, we could even see like a hint of you wanting to go in an Aero based on like we saw one of your edits.
Yeah.
With like I think it was like a Mars can. Landing, something like
it
that.
Was the food drive?
Yeah. It was the food drive. So you obviously wanted to go into aerospace for a long time, or at least it seems so. So what initially kind of made you want to go in this? Were you like as a kid you wanted?
This
just
is a fantastic
like...
story. I can tell a good story about this.
Okay.
When my family first immigrated to Canada, one of the first books that I remember my parents buying me was this really big book about space. So I didn't know how to read then, right? I didn't even know how to speak English. So I looked at the pictures, and my favorite thing in that entire book was a diagram that was depicting the mission profile of Apollo 8, the first mission to take humans to circumlunar orbit. Mm-hmm. And this is really beautiful, because the mission started on Earth. You had the Earth at the bottom of the page, and you had the Moon at the top of the page. And the rocket would go from the Earth to the Moon, and it would come back from the Moon to the Earth in a figure eight shape. I thought that was so beautiful. And the nice connection to now is that was a spacecraft trajectory in some sense, and now I'm designing spacecraft trajectories for my research. Wow. So I think that's extremely elegant and beautiful. That's a great story. So to go into detail then, the other thing in that book, my favorite section of that book was the section on space exploration. So there are a bunch of sections on like, here's the solar system, here are galaxies, here are nebulas, here are all these things. The thing that intrigued me the most wasn't so much what is out there in space, but how did humans explore space? So it wasn't just an interest in the natural sciences, it was an interest in applying science to something. And so engineering was something I was really interested from basically when I got that book. When I was a kid, I really liked, I had a train phase, I had a trucks phase. I had a book with like 100 different types of trucks. So like, here is a truck that transports wood. Here is a truck that pumps the sewage. Here is a truck that delivers food. All sorts of trucks. Like, I remember reading a book, it's like, this is a train that runs on steam. This is a train that runs on electricity. This is a train that runs on diesel. I thought that was really, really cool. So when I was a kid, I was obsessed with just going on like the NASA website, the NASA website, and just looking at all the rockets. So I think by grade three, I had memorized all of NASA's mainline launch vehicles that they were using at the time, like Delta II, Delta IV, and Atlas V.
Oh, wow.
That was super interesting. And then when I was in grade four, this game came out, it was called Kerbal Space Program. And so the first public release of the game was at the end of June in 2011. I started playing in the second week of July.
Damn.
So really, really good timing. I don't know how I discovered the game. I think I was just like clicking through YouTube videos when I was 9 years old. So I found someone playing the game. And between grade four and when I applied to university, I logged 1,300 hours in the game.
Oh, wow.
I think. So any time I had where I just wasn't doing things otherwise, I would like to play KSP. And that really, it reinforced my enjoyment in aerospace. Being able to just passively follow along with all the launches that were happening were really cool. I remember seeing the launch of STS-128 on TV. I never went to see any shuttle launches live. But playing KSP was something that really got me to engage with it because it felt like I was doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like that theme just goes throughout all of undergrad as well. The feeling of being able to actually engage with what I'm interested in, that is so important for actually getting me to where I am today. I think it's really tough for people nowadays growing up to engage with these highly, highly advanced topics like engineering and machine learning. That's why it's so important for stuff like high school robotics clubs and like high school coding classes to exist, because it lets people who are interested in this kind of stuff engage with it. I find that the more you can engage with something, the more you can get better at it, because you can think for yourself.
So would you say that's like that would be a useful piece of advice you'd give to exercises? Like, if you want to be able to get through it, you have to find something that makes you want to get through it?
Absolutely. The most important thing to do in exercise when you choose your major, so remember this for next year, do the thing you're interested in. Because the more interested you are in something, the more happy you are doing the something. And if you're happy, you're performant. Mm-hmm. That is the most universal true thing that I can say about exercise. When you are living life in a way that you can be happy, you will be extremely performant no matter what you do. And for the same thing goes for the best of your life. If you can find something that you can be happy doing, you will be the best.
And you mentioned space exploration. And that just kind of clicked in my mind. I don't know if you've seen like the news with, I think it was Elon Musk saying something crazy, why like 2050 or like in the next 100 years, he plans to put 1 million people, I think, on Mars.
That would be really cool.
I would find it really cool as well, but based on him and based on what you've seen, like, do you think that's like likely? Do you have like any optimism for when you see stuff like that on the news?
I'm not an expert in space exploration. I'm also only 23 years old, so I do not have any industry experience to speak of here. I think 1 million people on Mars by 2050 is too much. It sounds very ambitious. But it doesn't mean we won't have a lot of people on Mars by 2050. I think still getting a large volume of people on Mars by 2050 is very ambitious, and I don't think it's likely that we're going to have a massive colony on Mars by 2050, but I think by 2050, having had a single person land on Mars, why not? And maybe we will have a large permanent habitation established on the moon. Mm-hmm. I think in our lifetimes, and certainly in the lifetimes of the generations, to the one or two generations after us, we will see large-scale habitation on the moon and possibly even on Mars. The nice thing about humans is that we are perpetually curious about, you know what, like, that looks really hard, but we're going to try to do it anyways. So long as the challenge exists, there will be people who are going to try to make it happen. And it's just a matter of time. They just caught a 70-meter-tall flying building out of the air. Yeah. On two robotic arms. I don't know how many meters tall. Correct me on that. So if they can do that, I think the spirit is there to get to Mars. It's just a matter of allocating the people and the resources and the time.
The determination is still there. Yeah,
I think so.
I mean, that's kind of like inside. Like, there's a program this hard, but there's always people who want to go into it.
That's right.
And then, I mean, we're here. We're going through it.
You're here, and you've gotten through 2 full months of inside now.
Yeah.
So well done.
Thank you.
I think you mentioned it was 8% yesterday.
8% of the way to PEY.
Oh.
To PO.
There's still a long way to go.
And then plus another 4 years.
Yeah.
8 months of school year, 3 years, PEY, 24, yeah. 2 on 24, 1 on 12, 8.3%.
Oh, wow.
You still got a long way to go, guys.
Yeah.
But it's good. You've gotten through one thing. Now you only have 11 more things.
That's one way to look at it, yeah. Well, if you could distill, like, your Bible of EngSci, just for all EngSci's present and future, to know what it's like and what to do when you get here and how to survive it. Like, if you could summarize that in, like, 5 tips. Mingda's top 5 EngSci
survival tips. Yeah, so I prepared for this in advance in the shower last night, so I was thinking about this. Not a 5 tips, but I'll say three main concepts. The three main things you need to get right in EngSci are consistency, execution, and resilience. They're not separate, distinct ideas. They're in fact all related to each other, but I will elaborate on why they're so important to get right. What does consistency mean? Consistency means every single day you wake up and you're ready to keep doing EngSci. You wake up and your group members, if they're expecting you to do work, that work will be done. You wake up, you go to class, and every single day you learn, and you don't need to say, I'm tapping out, I'm calling it off for a day. What I mean by that is not you have to force yourself and discipline yourself to get up every single day. You can do that. What I'm saying is try to live your life in EngSci in a way such that being consistent is possible. So that is, get good sleep, get exercise when you can, eat well, drink water, be well, be happy. Execution. The sort of dual to consistency when it comes time to midterms, to your exams, to your civ quizzes, to getting big projects done. When you need to use every single bit of performance inside of you, you are there and you're ready to execute. Because for all the courses you're taking right now, your final exams are a substantial portion of your final grade. So in 2.5 hour blocks, you're going to be determining a large fraction of your future. So you need to be able to execute when that time comes. Finally, resilience. You won't always be able to execute. NSCI is the first time in your life, for many people, where you cannot have it all. In high school, it was not a question of, could you do well in all of your courses? It's, are you sufficiently disciplined to actually go and study and do well in all your courses? You have all the performance necessary to do it. But in NSCI, even if you use all of your performance, if you use up every single last bit of your performance, it might not be enough. And it is a reality that hits a lot of people very, very, very hard. But as NSCI, especially for all of you right here, you are all sufficiently smart to become successful in the future. If you were not smart enough to do that, you would not be in this program, you would not have been admitted to this program. Perhaps the single most important thing that this program is going to teach you is resilience, the ability to get back up after you've been knocked down, and knocked down very, very hard. It's not about the first time you get knocked down, not the second time. It's about when you get knocked down for the 49th time and the 50th time, and you keep trying for the 51st time. Because in the real world, you're never going to have the answers the first time around, maybe not even the 50th time around, but that 51st time when it actually succeeds. If you've already walked away and given up from the problem, you're not there when success wants to find you. So you need to still be there and have enough staying power to be there when you find success and success finds you. And if you can do that, you will become the top researcher in the world in whatever you do. You will be make the best business in the world in whatever you do. You will be the best engineer in the world in whatever you do. It is a matter of resilience. You are all brilliant and capable of doing whatever it is you wish to do, but you just need that resilience to be there so that time and time again, you can consistently execute.
And I think, wait, did we miss the first one?
Consistency, execution, resilience.
Resilience. Oh, yeah, those are the three.
Have you ever considered writing a book?
No, because books are really long. I'm not going to write it. No, maybe. This is a lot easier because I can just talk into the microphone.
Right.
Yeah.
This felt like a Stansby-esque type like speech for like motivation. Yeah, right before midterms come. Like,
okay, so let me talk about that a lot. Your professors, they really care about you. Mm-hmm. If they did not care about mentoring students, they would not be professors. I know it's very tempting sometimes to reduce your professors to beings that just give you lectures and nothing else. And it's from professors who have taught the course for many years. Like sometimes it can feel like they're just routinely giving you a lecture and maybe that they don't really care about your success, but they do. And not just in a way where they care about having the class pass and meeting a certain key performance indicator. They, as professors, have gone through the journey through academia, through undergrad, but not just through undergrad, but through grad school, through very, very, very hard journeys. And they know just how much support it takes to get from being a student to becoming a student who's graduated. And they know that it's not something that you do alone. So your professors are always there and always willing to help you if they are good professors, and all your professors are very good professors. So keep that in mind. Your professors are human, so be nice to them. But they also really do care about you deep down. It's just that there's 300 of you, so it's very hard for them to tell you individually one by one that they care so much about you, but they do. And it's very, very, very pleasing to professors to see students succeed, to see your students succeed. Many of you guys may all become professors in the future, and it's only when you've actually been able to witness the growth of someone that you've mentored succeed that you will feel so proud of them. That's a feeling that is it cannot be rivaled by anything else in the world. So your professors, they want you to succeed, in short. So even though not every single professor is going to give you a motivational speech like that, remember, that intention and that thought is there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wait. I have a question. Like, we're all first years here, except for you.
Yeah.
Like, what was your like most memorable moment from first year?
Okay, so when I was in PHY 180, we had a lecture where I think at some point we had finished the content for the lecture, and then a professor pulled up this game. It was written in Python. It was called gorillas.py. And the way the game works is that you have two gorillas, one on the left side of the screen and one on the right side of the screen, and there's a destructible terrain around them. And the gorillas throw exploding bananas. Your goal is to throw an exploding banana onto the other gorilla. And what you do is you program in the angle at which you launch the banana and the amount of power you give to launching the banana. And what you have to do is first the other gorilla may be blocked by terrain, so you have to throw bananas to destroy the terrain. And then you have to hit the other gorilla. So we took turns. And at one point, I think, so we had to basically, so the professor just had the computer, we guessed the angles and the launch powers. And at one point, like, just the gorilla was left, and the first guess happened to just be right that the banana landed on the other gorilla, and the class just went wild.
Wow.
This was like 150 people in the class just going, yeah! We got the banana ring. And that was really nice. That was the most memorable moment. That's my answer.
That's amazing.
That's like Angry Birds, but like, you have to program.
That's right.
That's sick.
It's the trajectory and the power as well.
Okay. That's right.
Except it's not like you can just like aim it. You have to like calculate the angle.
So that was really fun.
Just maybe not the final question, but I'm very curious. What is your favorite place to eat on campus?
Favorite place to eat on campus. So I do not eat much on campus. That's the thing. So when I was in first year, I lived at Chestnut, and I would just go back to Chestnut to eat. So when I was at Chestnut, they had the Wednesday and Friday fried rice. That was my favorite thing in the whole world. That was fantastic.
They had that today at lunch.
Good. So you know how they say like freshman 2015? Well, it's Chestnut 25. So
oh my gosh.
Chestnut was fantastic in first year. So I never had to eat on campus. So in first year, what I would do is I would just eat a really, really big breakfast. I would top it out during the day, and I'd just go back and eat a really, really big dinner. Second year, I was online for COVID. In third year, I was at Chestnut again, so similar things. In fourth year, so when I was back at Chestnut in third year, we had to get a meal plan. And when I was in third year, it wasn't you tap your card and you just eat. It was declining balance. So you had to pay for items, just like at New College nowadays. Mm. And we had I had some money left on my card still for fourth year. So I go to Sid's Cafe, and this thing doesn't exist on the menu anymore, at least not for the price that I had. There was something called chicken shawarma poutine. Fantastic deal. This thing was like 1,200 calories for like $6.99.
Damn.
What?
But they don't have it anymore.
So it's more expensive now.
It's like $13.
I think it's more expensive now. But that was fantastic. The portion size was really, really big. I think like I knew a handful of people who actually knew about this. So I think it didn't catch on until later, but then they noticed and they changed the prices. But then in terms of eating on campus, Green Truck is really good from hearing this from my friends. Green Truck is pretty good. I actually really only know about Green Truck because as MSI is like, it's right outside the common room, so it's like the first place that people will go.
Have you had the Pink Truck before?
No, I have not.
Oh, Pink Truck is like really good. They have a lot of stuff, like fried chicken, they have like fried chicken sandwiches, like fried rice as well.
That's fantastic.
Sounds like you would like the fried rice.
I like fried rice. Fried rice is my favorite, like one of my favorite things to eat. Like every morning right now is, so I cook for myself at home, right? But what I'll do is every night I'll make rice and I'll have extra rice. So in the morning I'll take the leftover rice and I'll make fried rice. Mm-hmm. And my day is good if I eat fried rice. My life is good if I eat fried rice. Rice is really good. Okay, so not on campus, but places, nice to eat places around campus. There's Shawarma Max, which is on College Street. They have a student discount. They have a chicken on the rocks for $8.99. And so after tax, and then so that's plus 13%, and then you take the student discount, which is minus 10%. It comes out to less than $10. Fantastic deal. Cosmic Pizza is also really good as well. Recently newly opened. Quite good deals for slices of pizza. And then Along's Banana. Oh, very good list of places. If you want to go after you eat. After class. New Ho King is fantastic. You probably saw that in the animated I Want to Come to MSI video.
Yeah.
I had to get my stomach pumped after getting eating New Ho King 20 times.
Wasn't that also in the Kendrick Lamar video?
Right. Fantastic place. Whenever I go there, I order the fried rice. It's fantastic. Very, very filling. There's a bunch of really, really nice places along Spadina. My recommendation is if you get free time with like your praxis team or a bunch of friends, and you guys are done class, go along Spadina, pick any random restaurant, walk in, eat. You will enjoy it.
That's amazing.
It's amazing.
Bro, I wish we knew about the fried rice earlier, because we were thinking of like bringing something on, like thinking what would your favorite food be? That would have been fitting.
That would have been amazing.
Yeah, maybe in the future we run round two with fried rice.
Good, good, good.
That would That'd be really funny.
Can I ask, how did you get the idea for this podcast?
Oh, actually,
it's a very funny story.
Okay.
Do we want to say it?
I think so.
I think it's fine. Yeah.
I think, for the first episode, we got to talk about it.
Right.
So we were actually in the other room.
Yep.
And we were just talking about having a platform in general, online.
Yeah.
And then we got to talking about, I don't know if you know, but Haley Welch. She went viral for a video where someone asked, I forget exactly what
they asked. I don't remember it, but she's said talk to a, and then she has a talk to a podcast now. Mm. You never heard of her?
No.
Really?
I'm old. I don't keep it up with the young folks these days. I don't know about this.
Oh, maybe it's because you don't doom scroll Instagram reels.
No, I don't. I know about Hawk Tua, but I didn't know they got a podcast. That's crazy.
Yeah, so she has a podcast, and it gets a lot of views.
Okay.
I think she averages 500,000 views per YouTube video.
Wow.
And we were talking about that. And we're like, it's crazy that someone just from a street interview just built up that much fame. And then we were like, wait, what if we started a podcast?
Right.
And beyond just being trying to impersonate some random girl on the internet, we were we thought it was a good idea to document our experience throughout university and have people on yourself who could have insightful conversations about what it's going through the process of doing things getting your co-op and what that experience was for you. So we thought that would be informative to share and to mm-hmm. propagate that information to people who might not know about NSCI or are just engineering in general for Canadian schools, because it's a lot more nebulous than with the American schools. And even beyond just engineering, we have a lot of ideas concerning just general university life and things of that nature. So that kind of...
I feel your tips were super good just in general.
Right.
For a university student.
Yeah.
Because it's not only applicable for NSCI students.
Yeah, in NSCI, you have to be good at all three of them.
But would you say that it's of your three tips, which is the most valuable for just anyone to apply to their life?
Just a final closing remark.
Oh, just resilience.
Resilience?
Yeah. But... The thing that I focused on personally the most throughout NSCI was being able to execute. I got really good at taking tests in NSCI, and part of that is just having the confidence knowing that you can execute.
Mm-hmm.
It helps a lot with nerves. Because one of the... I choked very hard on the Calc final in first year,
mm-hmm.
Calc 1 final, because I think not even halfway through the midterm, in the first 10 minutes of the final, I really started having thoughts. It's I can't do this, can I? This final, there's no way I'm doing this. But afterwards, cleaning myself up, fixing stuff up, going into assessments after that, having the reassurance that I can definitely do this. That helps you execute a lot. And execution is extremely important.
What gave you that confidence? Did you practice more? Was it just a mindset thing?
You kind of just got to do more. And I was very fortunate because I had all the support I need from my classmates beside me to do well in enough times that I learned that I could do a good job. The best way to succeed is to accumulate momentum succeeding, but it's really, really hard. It's exceptionally hard to bootstrap yourself onto figuring out how to get that success the first time. Because one of the most difficult situations you can get into in NSCI is to undershoot once, then you're behind the curve. And once you're behind the curve, NSCI is a game you do not want to play from behind. Mm-hmm. It gets even harder. And the more that you see you keep reaching and you can't find success, you learn a sort of helplessness. And that's a very, very, very bad spiral to get into. So it takes a lot of work to dig out of it. And likewise, once you succeed, it's really, really easy to try to keep on pushing that momentum. So what I will say to that then, if you want to get good at executing, selectively remember your experiences in NSCI. Focus on what you're good at. When you find something that you're good at, which is also why I like to say do things you're interested in, because you tend to be good at the things you're interested in. If you focus on the things you're good at and you can continuously find success in that specific thing, your successfulness will be contagious and it will spread into everything else.
Right. I think that's everything for today.
Fantastic. Yeah, I think so.
Thank you so much for
coming on.
Thank
you so much.
Of course, thank you for having
me.
Are you going to make your outro announcement?
Tune in for next week.
Make sure to follow us on all our socials linked in our bio.
Like the episode and make sure to make suggestions of what we should talk about with our next guest.
If you want to be on the podcast, fill out the form also in our bio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching.
We're all here. Fantastic.
Hey, nice.